spoilers ahead.
This is a spoiler warning.
Spoilers. 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 Spoilers.
Mike, and Oscar Sprint, spoilers!
And we're back once again. It's been a while since you've heard that song and those beautiful lyrics, but it's true. We have basically an Oscar Sprint profile again. Haven't had one since Black Panther came out in February, but now we're thinking this movie is worthy of that title, and that's how we're going to kind of approach this episode. It is part two of our Hereditary review. This is Mike, and Oscar. I am your co-host, Mike One. This is my co-host, also Mike.
I'm also Mike. This movie's getting a lot of Oscar buzz, or clucks, or whatever you want to call it there.
I think clucks is the actual appropriate, it's the official title of what that sounds like.
You were very proud of our Easter egg at the end of the spoiler-free episode.
I figured it was 80 episodes, it was finally time for one.
My face lights up the few times I played that, but it made my day when I heard that at the end, because I forgot about it, and I remembered it. And so yeah, go back, listen to the end of our first part one, because I think these two pods go together. It's not either or, like we said in Star Wars Last Jedi, Black Panther, where we did a two-parter. So do listen to part one. We're not going to rehash everything we did in part one.
Yeah, no, and part one was the non-spoiler review, spoiler-free, and this part two, and why we put the spoiler warning at the top of the episode, like you heard, is we're going into the deep dive with Hereditary here. We're going into the twists and turns, some of the allegories, some of what we think they may mean, and we're going to top off the episode. Also, Mike has a very unique take on this movie in totality. It is not one that either one of us have been able to see or find on the internet otherwise. It's something wholly independent that he has come up with, and personally, I think it's a really, really cool perspective and angle taken on this movie.
Yeah, it's about aliens, and the aliens are real.
Right.
They're
right.
Actually real. It's about real aliens, and the people who live in caves are called mole people. And those two
society
forces.
Society is run by an Illuminati.
There's the lizard people, right. But that's different than the mole people.
Right, of course, yeah. Of course. And we're going to get into all that at the end of this
I'll
episode.
Build up to it.
But it is the spoilers of Hereditary, and we're going to start off, like I said, go back and listen to part one for all the non-spoiler details. But part two, we're talking about Hereditary. We're going to finish up with some stuff that we left hanging or update some stuff, such as the specs, which we're going to start with here in part two of the Hereditary. We said that the box office was on pace for about $8 to $10 million. It's $13.5 million is what it pulled in at the opening weekend. In the last 2 days alone, it has pulled in another $4 million as we tape this on June 13th. So its lifetime right now is at $17.2 million. But that 13.5 number is about $5 million, I think, more. $5.5-6 million more than the original projection of $8 million, which it was supposed to do on its first opening weekend. So it's already outperforming.
Biggest opening weekend ever for A24. It's also A24's biggest release. You know, cards on the table there. They haven't done many wide releases. The Witch was a semi-wide release. It got $8.8 million. That was their number one before this. The Hereditary beat it out by quite a bit.
Yeah, A24, we keep gushing about it, and it's becoming a critical darling. But yeah, The Witch was a beloved property, if not polarizing. Lady Bird, obviously, we talked about a lot during last year's Oscar race. And now Hereditary is its biggest hit to date, like also Mike just told you. Right.
And by its second weekend with that $10 million budget, it's going to be in the profit zone already. So
yeah, it's definitely a moneymaker. And again, something that I am shocked got through the hands of Jason Blum and Blumhouse. But it's nice to have two movie-making studios that know how to properly do horror. Let's address some carryovers from the non-spoiler review of the part one of this episode that came out last week. Let's talk about some soundtrack and score stuff. You said when we first did the non-spoiler part, the soundtrack to you, the score to you, was not so memorable.
I listened to some of it on YouTube. I couldn't listen to all of it. That was
say,
not
that's
some evil
productive
that
music,
I want.
Huh? No, able to get a lot done.
I'm pretty sure you summoned demons
when
with
you
that
prayed
music.
With that in the background. Did thunder strike or was it lightning first?
I was way too afraid, seriously, rattled and afraid to listen to that music all the way through. No way. However, I did remember like all those you know, signature moments in the songs coming back to me, flooding back to me. And it worked. I mean, there's blaring noises.
Yes.
There's noises that sound like typical demon noises. There's like bullhorns that sound like the low demon noises. There's the Hitchcock shower scene sound, the rink, 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 in different amalgamations.
What was that sound again? Thank you. Very, all right.
And then
very
there's
good.
Also the, there's a lot of buildup to these songs where it just feels like crickets in the woods or all the sounds of nature in the background, and then something sinister starts up from there. So yes, a very unique soundtrack, if I can say the least, and one that is impossible to listen on Spotify or YouTube because it is...
Well, it's manipulative. I mean, it changes...
No, the devil lives in those notes. I'm sorry.
And it's also funny, I thought, that how happy they made the end sound, the end song, when the Peter character is finally coming to his senses, which we'll address in a little bit. But how uplifting and happy it turned on a dime. And if you were to take that in a vacuum and just listen to that song, you'd think, oh, this is a Disney movie.
Yeah, I mean, it's a tragic arc for the characters, but not the filmmaker and the for
or
the
demons.
No, he successfully made a genre movie, Hidden Hail Payment.
Right. So, yes, I think there was a little more to the sound and the score than we let on in the first part. And it's a multiple viewing type thing. And this is one of those movies, without question, that you're going to get more the more times you do view it. I think we've both seen it in theaters at least twice each. I know. I don't know if you saw it more.
No, just twice. Okay.
But because it is a movie you're going to see twice, this is kind of where I pump my brakes as far as the Oscar lens, and this is what we'll talk about right now, the Oscar lens of this movie. I saw this for the second time today, earlier today in the afternoon, so it was my Podunk Theater, your favorite place on earth, which, by the way, there's a total difference in quality of the HD screens, I noticed, because reading
you're
some
just
text,
noticing this now. It's like the boy who moves to the big city.
Yeah, you've ruined this
and then
for
goes
me.
Back.
I was happy in my little cocoon, and you've ruined this.
Your small pond movie theater.
The
and
seat
you just...
where it hugs either side of my, my what do you call these things,
you're
spare
tires.
You're
a big fish now.
Yeah, big, emphasis on big. So... I saw it it was a relatively empty theater. It was me, another male, and two elderly women, my dates, basically.
Yeah.
The reason I don't think this is going to do well, generally speaking, to the general public, when I got up, I was ready to leave the theater. I got the two elderly women stopped me, and literally verbatim, they said, "Do you understand what this movie was about?" And I was like, well, yeah, I started explaining my take on it and the things that happened on the screen. And they were just peppering me with questions about what does this mean? What does this mean? What is?
Yeah.
And I think that might be a general theme. And we talk about the cinema score. The cinema score for this was a D minus. The general audience is not grasping to this, but it's very critically well received. And so I think just based on that alone, and obviously it's a small sample size, ridiculously tiny, but... You and I talked about our first viewing of this, how we had questions. We even held off this episode in specific because we didn't want to give takes that unless they marinated in ourselves a while first.
We were just going to be like too many, WTF this,
exactly.
WTF that, I thought, yeah.
So to me, that might keep it out of Best Picture consideration, where something like Get Out was more universally understood the first time, I think you could say.
Right. It's not the Rubik's Cube.
Right.
That this one at least is on the surface... Rubik's Cube's the wrong word, but it is a bit of a puzzle.
Get Out's a cheese Danish, and this is a piece of baklava with all its layers.
Yes.
I'm fat, is what I'm saying here.
That sounds delicious. I've never been more attracted to you.
So, to me, I think Toni Collette, without question, best actress nomination. I would be shocked at this point to not at least hear her name.
Everybody's thrown her in as almost a shoo-in at this point.
I think screenplay, it has an outside chance. You think it has a great chance at original screenplay at this
point. Best original screenplay, I could see it. If rewatches of this film falls down for me, then maybe not. But right now, I'm thinking yes.
Best original screenplay would not surprise me at all. Best picture is where I draw the line. You happen to think this might be a best picture? A nominee, at least?
Well, it is political, and it is, like you said, the broader audience has a say. The Academy has expanded.
It's true.
But the critical eye does, a lot of those precursor awards are funneled through the critic. This will be an interesting Oscar experiment, I think. You know, this is a pure horror movie.
Yes.
It ascribes to, at the end of the day, at the end of the movie, genre conventions.
Yeah.
Very much so.
Hard.
Now,
yeah.
This is not that horror movie wrapped in an Oscar movie. Right?
No.
Like Get Out was
no,
very
no, no.
much
yeah.
that genre bender. This is horror movies. Now, you're right. Will it Will it be nominated?
That's
I don't know.
What we're going to see. And Toni Collette's face scares the shit out of me, and I don't ever want to encounter her because she'll yell at me. And
some
I just
small
a puddle of mush.
Yeah, some smaller stuff. Production design, I think, is going to happen. I think that's...
You were harping on that in part one as well, and I totally agree. I think whoever is responsible for these miniatures, too, in this movie, my
there's
lord.
There's artistry there. There's connections that we made in the first episode from the miniatures to the real setting. I do think Alex Wolff, if he is a best supporting actor somehow, even though I think he's probably considered the lead, male lead in this movie, I think if he's put in the supporting category, he might have a chance. I'm a big fan of Gabriel Byrne's performance more upon rewatch.
Is he Irish?
Yes.
All right. That was the brogue that I was hearing. Yeah.
I can't say it.
That was it, yeah. I think that was Earth, Wind, and Fire.
Top of the rainbow to you, Gabriel Byrne.
Yeah, the accent slipped out in a couple scenes with him.
I had to twist my face like the end of Hereditary, and then I got it. I got the accent.
These facial jokes doing a lot for you guys out there? Let us know. I, along those lines, Millie Shapiro is not going to get Oscar consideration. She was great in her role, and I was kind of blown away with how much she was tasked with doing to get this plot
moving. I do think
she
stands a chance. If this movie builds momentum, then I think she'll be included. And Dowd's kind of the same way, just because she's so revered overall.
If she gets the script for a screenplay for a comedy, she's not going to know what to do with herself. No. I mean, or a sitcom, she's going to be blown away.
It'd be the scariest sitcom ever after Handmaid's Tale. And, oh my God, True Detective.
Yeah, we just had to pause because I had to look up. I thought she was Margot Martindale in The Millers, and I thought that was an endowed role, but of course, I should have known better.
They might be the same person.
They are very strikingly similar.
Yeah.
And Endowed, not going to ever make anyone laugh in a sitcom.
What's the difference between Margot Martindale in The Americans and Anne Dowd in The Leftovers? I don't see much.
Until you said that, I thought it was Anne Dowd in The Americans. I'm not lying. So that shows my...
I thought it was Margot Martindale in The Handmaid's Tale, too. Yeah.
So there we are with that. Anyway.
Dermot Mulroney and Dylan McDermott.
We have another one for the list. Oh, where the fuck are we?
We're still in the Oscar lens.
Goddamn. Go ahead.
I was going to say that best director seems like a possibility. It's a very control. If this kid, he's a first-time director, we'll see what kind of narratives are going to be out there.
Yeah, it's not unheard of, right? We just went through this with Jordan Peele. Jordan Peele obviously had the history and the lineage of being familiar with people in the Academy, so maybe that's more a point to his favor. And obviously, two vastly different movies, even though they are horror. That's another delineation we discussed in part one of this episode. I don't know. I personally wouldn't. I think there's already at least three or four Best Director nominees that I would have higher than this. So.
Yeah, you're not as high on this movie as I am. I don't know. I don't know how the general Academy is going to vote, and it's going to be very intriguing to watch this play out.
This is definitely a movie we're going to hear about throughout the year.
Those precursor award shows, let's just see how many noms it gets.
Look
at Black Panther. It got 14 noms at the Sci-Fi Awards, so if it blows out, if there's a horror movie award precursor show and it gets every nomination in the book and it wins 10, it's
totally
make
right.
Some
and
sense.
We say it every year. There's an indie film every year that becomes the darling that everyone just grasps onto and wants to shake for everything it's worth. We saw it last year with an A24 property. Lady Bird could have been considered one of those.
This is hard to consider a darling, though, in a way.
Well, it's a darling in that you have to love the evil inside you.
No, you embraced what I said. I'm just trying to back away.
So let's talk about the twists and turns. Let's get into the plot breakdown for Hereditary. We're going to try to make this as conversationally as possible.
It's a demon possession film. That's the
genre.
And I think that was hidden in the marketing and in the premise at the beginning to a certain extent. I knew we had a cult involved, but I didn't know the cult's entire job was to get a vessel for this demon, I didn't think that was their sole purpose throughout this film, throughout the first act.
Yeah, I'd go so far as to say I didn't think it was a demon possession film until about two-thirds through the movie.
Right.
To me, at least, the setup was it's going to be about the kid, it's going to be about the kid's spirit, Charlie maybe, and then you find out there's this whole payment storyline.
It's kind of clever, but when you watch how it builds up, you have definitely a seance. You have how many seances?
Right.
You have the two seances at the beginning and end of Act Two, or the beginning and middle of Act Two, rather. So it's definitely building up to it, and yet still we're like, wait, this is not Rosemary's Baby. This is not The Wicker Man.
And not a religious demon. I mean, at least conventionally religious, dealing with God and
he purposely did not want any Christian symbols. He did not want any upside down cross.
Thank you.
Crosses. He did not want any 666s. He didn't want any of that because he didn't want to give it away. I mean, in many ways, this movie surprises you that it's a, like you just said, demon possession movie. Okay.
So we have this symbol, this family symbol. We start obviously in the funeral procession for this mother figure. It's Toni Collette's mother, Ellen.
It's a very weird symbol because there's three circles in the middle.
Yeah.
It feels like three heads underneath another head. I don't know if it's four circles.
Yeah, I don't know either. It's a very unique symbol, and it's obviously one special to them. The Ellen character in her casket and Annie, who was Toni Collette's character, both wear the same symbol on their chest.
Right.
Obviously, it has to do with this cult that Ellen was the head of, which has come to be shown.
You know what? I think I remember what it is. She, at the end, doesn't she say something like, "We reject the Trinity"? So to put the king of hell over the three heads of the Trinity and to actually remove the heads on the bodies.
Yeah.
My mother is just turning this off in her car right now.
If you're a religious person, we're done to you. But yeah, that's a really good point. Not one I had thought of. But mom,
we're going to talk about it in a snappy way.
So spoiler, this is about a cult rejecting Christianity and trying to open the gates of hell.
I pictured my mother listening to this. I know she does listen. Hi, Mom.
They're trying to reincarnate and put one of the kings of hell, Paimon, into the vessel of a...
If you say his name correctly,
I know,
he comes.
I'm terrified of doing so. Of putting it...
Paimon?
Into the vessel of one of the boys in this bloodline. And the hereditary part of this is that this family has a lineage of this demon either following them around or inhabiting them or controlling them at times, etc.
So I did want to touch on a bunch of the setup and the exposition that's gradually revealed, even expositions that later on. I just want to talk about it all up front if we can.
Yeah.
Toni Collette's mother, Ellen, is the queen of this satanic cult.
Which becomes readily apparent. Very obvious.
She's literally married in a ceremony to King Paimon with coins showered upon her heads. The occult book tells us that Paimon is the god of mischief.
Not Loki. So we're out of the MCU.
Right. The conjurer or the magician, if you read anything online, will inherit, I guess is the right word, the punny word, a fortune. And they literally show a man sitting on a mound of treasure.
Scrooge McDuck
in an occult book. Okay. See, occult books are not that scary.
Famous
last words. So...
Hey, Mike, read this text.
A fortune is promised to the conjurer, like I said.
Mm-hmm.
When Ellen dies, this is the grandma, Ellen, the cult, which is represented by that three-man riding a donkey symbol, the rejection of the Trinity, they dig up the grandmother's body, and Gabriel Byrne is given a call and later on looks at the pictures in the email of the...
desecration of the grandmother's grave, yes.
Yes, so they decapitate that corpse... Later on, they...
Which is something we don't find until the final act of the movie.
They stage it in there. Mike is against the fact that they can stage it in there, and you make a good argument.
I don't think you could have a party without someone knowing in your house, but I don't know.
All right. I don't know. I don't know if I sleep like the dead. Maybe I'm... Paimon's with me at night. I don't know. So the three heads literally become the grandma, mom, and daughter. They all lose their heads in this movie.
Literally lose their heads, by the way.
Literally.
I mean, we're not talking symbolism yet. This is all just what you see on the screen so far.
Yes. The symbol exists on necklaces worn by the grandma. It is also on the back of a telephone pole as they pass it going to the party. That's the older brother and the daughter. Chekhov's telephone pole. So Toni Collette's character seems to have been haunted by this demon already. She's already sculpted memories of her phantom mother haunting her throughout her...
The miniatures and what she does for professionally. She has these setups, and that's kind of her way of coping with grief as well, is she's able to sculpt dioramas, basically.
Dioramas that, yeah, she has big art, artsy-fartsy...
Miniature...
Showings.
Yeah, pieces. Sure. Okay.
Bougie. Charlie is primarily cared for by the grandma before her dementia. Now, the grandmother also has DID, dissociative identity disorder, which could be obviously attributed to the demon possession.
Sure.
Or even if it's not in her, it's she's kooky talking to a demon, which in the reality of this movie is real.
You walk the fine line throughout this entire script of what is a mental illness and what is actual cult philosophy.
Good point. The grandfather and father on that point, the Toni Collette character, the daughter, she goes to a grief group at the beginning of this movie.
And this is where the majority of the exposition kind of comes in. She admits that her brother died a heinous death.
Yeah, her brother hung himself, and her father starved himself.
Starved himself. And the brother hung himself, accusing her mother of putting other people in him, which is a quote that she said at the grief counseling.
So at one point, she's hanging later from the ceiling like her brother, right? Mm-hmm. That generation hanging from the ceiling while she does what she does. We'll get there.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't see a lot of people eating good food in this movie, so maybe that's the starving.
Oddly enough, the two old women couldn't stop munching the whole time.
So yes, there's mental illness in the text of this movie in the family. Now, you can attribute that to demon possession, the wife, Ellen, Grandma Ellen, trying to pass this demon along to all the males in the family, one after another, see what if anything takes. It never takes,
right?
Up to this point. So apparently, at the beginning of this movie, the demon is in Charlie, is part of Charlie.
Being the little girl of the family.
The little girl,
yes.
the girl with the scars, who's also a huge Broadway star, I just found out. Yeah, when we do our Oscar Sprint profile down the line, we'll have to bio them a little bit.
Yeah, she's you could tell she's loaded with talent.
She's a big deal. So the mother sleepwalks going into this film. Again, more exposition here.
Yes.
Going into this film, she actually has her worst episode of sleepwalking when she covers her husband and son with paint thinner and actually strikes that match before the son, her husband, wakes up. I don't remember who they said they woke up.
I think it was the son.
Okay. They wake up. She wakes up. She stops.
Yeah.
So in her subconscious driving her, I don't know if that's a demon or if that's she's trying to save her family from the demon, whatever. She's super duper mentally ill trying to deal with this force of nature.
And it's important to remember where we are in the story because, like we said, you're not sure how seriously to take this demon possession storyline until well into the movie. So at this point, you're walking that tightrope. Well, is she really telling us what's actually going on? Is she having a deteriorating mental state? Is she actually possessed by a demon? Etc., etc.
Right. You don't know if it's a reliable or an unreliable narrator.
There you go. Those are screenwriting terms.
I agree wholeheartedly with that statement that I just made. The house, but basically, this house is haunted. This house is haunted, and it's not obviously haunted until later in the movie, like you said. So,
and that's part of what makes this screenplay so great. We're not dealing with an Amityville horror situation where the walls are bleeding and coming at you.
But the walls are bleeding and coming at them later on. But no,
subtly.
That there's a lot of subtext there, and you when upon rewatch when you see how Gabriel Byrne's husband character treats Toni Collette walking on eggshells with her, it's for a very specific reason. She tried to burn them alive in her sleep a few years ago, and when he emails
the psychiatrist
and he's like, I think she's having another episode, but he doesn't send the email, whatever, if the demon is in his head too, and he won't send the email.
Well, he got interrupted by the pictures.
Of
the desecration of the grave. That's when he was going to send the email.
Oh, good catch right there. So this explains a lot of the inexplicable plot movements that are to come.
What was the term you used about the plot hole, not being able to find plot holes in this movie? The armor?
There's a lot of plot armor. Because you have a supernatural. Term.
Everything that you think is a plot hole can be attributed to this questionable demon possession, which becomes a very real and tangible thing in the third act.
And you also have a cult that can scurry without being...
touching the ground.
Without leaving any clues.
Yes. It's always nice to have those in your back pocket.
I know where everything is in my house. I would know if 12 naked guys came into the house before this episode, and I had the audacity to actually argue with you. I think that's actually a good point. Well, it's actually growing on me now.
Maybe I just booby-trap better than you do, Michael.
All right, so the cult members...
First floor of my house is just littered with mouse traps.
This movie starts with the funeral of Grandma Ellen. It starts with the little write-up on her at her eulogy. Now the Toni Collette is giving her eulogy after the family's woken up. The daughter sleeps in the demon house, the tree house.
As one does.
Ice-cold tree house, because only demons can sleep in the ice-cold, I guess.
Which was also a very artistic shot. Every time there's someone in the treehouse at night, you see the red reflecting of the heaters, the space heaters.
Payman's domain there. Yeah. These cult people have very cult-like smiles, smiling at the little girl, Charlie, who's eating chocolate, which is even creepier. The girl also sees a vision later on of her grandmother worshiping by a fire in her white dress again, which isn't really there.
And that's, again, another attribute to another tick in the tally, a tally mark in the column of, are we really seeing this? Is this all happening or is it not?
I think if it stuck with the daughter, it might have been unreliable narrator territory. I think once the daughter's taken out, and I guess we get into that, that's in terms of closings to act one.
Oh man,
to thrust you into act two. My god. Now, first time we watched it, Toni Collette is agreeing with the son that there's going to be alcohol at the party, right?
Right. She's a realistic, rational mother.
So why don't you take your 13 years old, 7th grade, socially awkward.
Well, wait a minute.
Sister.
If we're going to talk about problems with the party, you went to high school parties, right, Michael?
No.
Okay. Well, I know people who did.
Friend of mine.
Have you ever heard of a fucking charcuterie outlet, like a cake on a platter in high school parties? This layout of food? I had friends that literally shit on floors in our high school parties, all right? We didn't have layouts of beautiful grandeur.
I don't know. Some of the high school parties, I went to a prep school, so some of them were kind of bougie.
Oh, you bougie,
I didn't like them.
Bitch.
I forgot. With you right now.
I forgot they showed you movies in your school.
There's some bougie ass, but we see at the party when they get there. Again, they go past the Payman cult symbol telephone pole.
Which I didn't see twice, by the way. I had to read about. Mike has assured me it's there.
It's there.
I'm sure it is. I'm just that
unsuspecting. Reminded to me on the 17 videos that I watched going in here today. So it is at the party where there's a girl chopping up walnuts, right?
Yes, 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 yes. Very.
So the daughter was being chastised by her parents. She's allergic to nuts. Is there nuts in that chocolate bar? No. All right, set up.
Well established. Okay.
We have the son liking this girl from a scene we saw in his class, likes this girl that he sits behind in class, and he wants to smoke weed with her.
Where are we? Is this a coming-of-age movie? Is she going to get possessed? Yeah, where are we in this screenplay? What is this going to be still?
She is eating the cake, drinking water, and struggling. The son is hanging out with the girls. She comes in, I can't breathe.
Right.
So it's just like, a surprising reversal for that scene, because it was hard to put together. I thought that was very, very clever. Now, I thought for one of the more batshit finales to an act one, I thought they worked up to it very well.
Totally didn't see it coming.
That sequence was phenomenal, but there's also great reasons, causality for each for what happens. And he's driving back, going to the hospital.
So he's speeding. He's trying to get her. She's suffering anaphylactic shock, basically. She can't breathe. She's doing the universal sign for choking, trying to struggle. And all he cares about is getting his sister.
Opens up the window.
Yeah. All he cares about is getting his sister to the hospital. She's struggling for air. He's telling her it's going to be okay. This real frantic state, even though they are alone on this open road, which I thought was a nice dichotomy. She rolls down the window. She sticks her head out, trying to breathe. And he comes across this carcass of a deer or some beast.
Fox.
In the road. He swerves to avoid.
Might be a three-headed bat.
He swerves to avoid. She smacks her head onto the aforementioned telephone pole.
Great.
My God.
Timothy Chalamet looking at a fire. Focused stare.
Great, great analogy.
Alex Wolff there. So if Timothy Chalamet gets nominated, maybe Alex Wolff has a chance in hell there.
Not a bad parallel, yeah.
I think what he does makes sense. He is so in shock at what just happened.
Sells it 1,000%.
And he just drives the car with his sister's headless body in it.
One of my favorite shots is you see from his perspective how he wants to look in his rearview mirror to see what's going on with his sister.
And
he can't bring himself to do it.
Gets caught. Yeah. He goes, he just catches his own breathing when he does that. I thought that was a brilliant job by him. So now we have Toni Collette leaving
the next morning, getting into the car, but we only see Peter in bed. We hear Toni Collette get into the car, discover the body, shrieks.
It flashes forward to Toni Collette grieving, just going off, in the bedroom, her husband comforting her to the funeral.
Die. Yeah.
Which does a very David Lynchian cross cut down into the ground, like a dollhouse goes.
Were you expecting ants to be warring when you got in the grass exactly. level? Yeah.
The inexplicable actions of Toni Collette. If you buy the fact that the demons are working on her, and if you buy the fact that her performance is a little bit off, like I said in the first episode, I think that connection works. Like, the demons working on her, that presence is already there. She's in a slight trance when she agrees to send her seventh grade daughter to a high school party.
Yeah, but I would argue that's not something you can come up with until you've seen this movie once already, right? I mean, you're still on your first viewing, and I think this is kind of cool. You're doing it as an experience view, and I'm kind of trying to pace people through what the first time viewing you would feel. You still don't know what's going on. You know the daughter died tragically. You know the son is very affected, and you know Toni Collette is grieving harder than anyone we've seen so far.
So Act Two starts up. Look, this is where the cult really sinks its teeth in to this family, and obviously where the demon has to lose control and then take more control. Because really, the demon is the antagonism, yes, but the antagonism wins in a tragedy. So the demon is kind of the central through line. So the demon actually, at the end of Act One, in order for him to enhance his station, he has to kill his vessel. So he is left without a vessel. Anne Dowd is the leader of this cult. She has to basically manipulate the wife into reopening whatever door.
And the way
through
this
the seances
is so beautiful.
Yeah.
We see this arbitrary shot of the family's mail. And we see they have one of those old school mail doors on their front door, a little passage that you could pass mail in between. It lands on the floor in your foyer.
Right.
We see a figure on the other side, because we can see the shadow. We see a figure on the other side, the outside of the door, come by, and the mail is hanging in that slot, and they slip this seance piece of paper on top. Obviously, that was meant for Toni Collette to see and take up on her own accord. That doesn't happen. So what does Anne Dowd do as a member of this cult? She says, fuck it, I'm going to do this personally. Hunts down Toni Collette when she's going to another meeting for this group therapy session.
Now, I don't remember seeing Anne Dowd in the first meeting.
She wasn't there.
Right.
Yeah, so she wasn't there. She's manipulating. This is total manipulation on the part of the cult mm-hmm. through Anne Dowd's character.
Anne Dowd, honeypot. Okay, keep going.
Yeah, the king Best of comedy. The queen of comedy, Anne Dowd. She manipulates Toni Collette and tells her whether maybe a true story, who knows, hunts her down at this meeting, says, listen, if you ever want to talk, Toni Collette's resistance to it. Anne Dowd goes even further, says, my son died. I had to watch my son and my husband die. They drowned in front of me. In front of me. That creates the connection enough for Toni Collette to actually accept her number. She takes Anne Dowd's number. Mm-hmm. Toni Collette moves on with her life, thinks that she may or may not ever contact this person again.
As this is happening in a few scenes spread out, where Anne Dowd as a cult leader is getting her hooks into Toni Collette. Toni Collette's dioramas are getting increasingly more personal. The grandmother being involved, with the grandmother haunting her early on in the movie and then being in the dioramas. It gets to a point where in the middle of the movie, she's actually making a diorama of her daughter's accident scene,
which is horrific to look at.
So Anne Dowd gets Toni Collette to come back to her house and perform a seance.
After another quote-unquote run-in with Toni Collette, she sells this idea of the seance. They go back to Anne Dowd's place. They perform this seance under the guise that Anne Dowd is contacting her grandson that has moved
this
beyond.
Works. So essentially, it's reopening the doors for Payman and Charlie or whatever. And Anne Dowd he basically manipulates Toni Collette into performing her own seance, trying to get Charlie back. Now, Charlie fills her Toni Collette to where Toni Collette's speaking in Charlie's voice. So, all right, Charlie's back.
Yes.
All right, so Charlie / Payman, whatever, Payman's back.
And Charlie is back and terrified, by the way.
Yeah. So the the husband and the son are on high alert. They're totally freaking hell out. The son is at trying to just do his old thing, smoking weed with his buddies under the bleachers. Cliche for sure. And he can't even, he's having like PTSD and he's taking on the symptoms of his sister's anaphylactic shock, like you said at the beginning. The son I forget if Anne Dowd is seen across the street before he slams his head. It has to be.
It is.
So it has to be. The son sees Anne Dowd doing these incantations across the street. He doesn't even know who she is, Anne Dowd. It's just Anne Dowd. But he slams, he gets contorted by the demon and is slammed into his own desk, which breaks his nose. And for some reason, the father takes him home and not to a mental hospital. Again, the father might be a little bit influenced.
Yeah, this is a father on his last legs of sanity, too.
Meanwhile, Toni Collette is at home finding her headless mom's corpse.
As one does.
Attic.
You never know what you have up there. There's a lot of boxes. It always gets cluttered around fall time.
They're heavy sleepers, obviously, like Mike said. So the son is basically a groggy mess that the husband wants to just lie down and not take to mental hospital, but fine. The wife is just going nuts, and they all had a seance the other night, so everybody's on edge. But they heard their daughter's voice.
By the way.
Their dead daughter's voice. Right. We talked about it.
Minor detail.
So Toni Collette basically strong arms the husband into looking in the attic. The husband doesn't believe
Confirming.
Her.
Confirming. She needs confirmation from an objective viewer that A, she's not going crazy. B, she needs her husband to buy in to this batshit
happening.
She's trying
to get him to buy in. So he didn't really do it at the seance and he doesn't do it now. So he's still resistant. He goes up, screams. And then his first inclination, because he thinks she's still crazy, is that she desecrated the grave.
Yes.
All right.
You dug it up because Toni Collette had been lying to him about going to the movies when she actually was going to these group therapy sessions.
Group therapy sessions. So he is basically reluctantly brung downstairs. She has the book, which she tried to destroy earlier.
And my God, that scene where she's begging him to destroy it, with that walking scene where
it's her climax.
2 miles an hour. Oh, my God.
It's her climax of the movie. The crisis for her at that scene, which a lot of people didn't understand and a lot of people didn't go over. I think that's the most brilliant acting moment of the movie.
Totally with you.
She wants, and this, I guess, it's going to be my best scene.
It's definitely one of mine as well. Yeah.
Even I probably, it might be a tick. Once I figured it out, it might be a tick above the dinner table scene, although her Oscar reel showcase is in that dinner table scene. Basically, she thinks she's going to burn to death because when she put the book in there last time, she thinks this is like the magic book where the demon's living. She thinks that once she throws it in there, her arm will catch on fire.
She's convinced that she has some connection to this book because she tried to burn it once. Her arm caught on fire, so she's convinced the book needs to be destroyed for the demon to leave, but it would also destroy her.
The demon's in the house. Yeah, the demon's not in a book. So it's also in a book, right? So basically, she's giving her husband like a talk about how he's the love of her life, that she just needs him to have faith in her and to do what she's asking him to do, and he refuses to do it at the end of the day. So she doesn't want to kill herself. She'd rather he throw it in and then she'll burn but save
the
family.
She has the strength to accept her own demise, but she doesn't have the strength to actually perform her own demise.
Right.
Which is ironic.
Suicide by cop or whatever, you know. So when he won't do it, she makes the climactic decision to throw it in there herself. But she doesn't burn. He does.
Immediately. Combusts into flames.
So talk about reversal. Talk about, a scene that's brilliantly built up and she's playing the shit out of it. Gabriel Byrne's performance, his stoic performance.
Emphasis
in
that scene. On Burns, huh?
Yeah, it's remarkable. I'm thrilled with that scene, even though this is as fucked up as it gets in any movie.
It's a total in line with as the string of what the fuck occurrences.
This is, yeah, so that right there is not the first totally WTF, but it is the biggest one to date.
Yes.
And now we have supernatural possession of the mother. The mother at her weakest, she just watches her husband burn alive. You get that screaming, that gif where she's looking around and pivoting and totally freaking out. She just thought she was going to die. She was ready for death herself. She had no idea what she just did would kill her husband, the love of her life, after that pleading speech. So,
and her face goes from terrified to we see that flash of light that we
throws her eyes
come
up
to know,
the air.
And she comes basically dead. Her eyes go dead.
That's it. That's the end of Toni Collette's character in this movie, essentially being...
Not the end of her body.
Being controlled. Yeah. So her body is basically a shadow on the walls, literally living in the wall while the sun wakes up and looks away.
Terrifying.
So she's like flying
through
the house. as the son wakes up groggily looking what the hell's going on, goes down and sees the father, goes up and sees the mother. The mother chases him up into the attic. He gets up there, but the attic door closes. The mother bangs her head on the door. Scariest scene ever.
She's just hanging in midair, banging her head.
Banging her head really hard on the door, just psychotically, insanely scary. He's up there. He sees all the cult members.
Mm-hmm.
Well, he saw them downstairs, too. They were naked. They were gross.
They're surrounding the house.
Walks up to the attic and sees more of them. He sees the full ritual on display of the grandmother's corpse or whatever. Or no, I don't know if he sees the grandmother's corpse.
He doesn't then. Maybe it had already been moved. Yeah.
But he sees
all
the
outline of her corpse.
Yeah, he sees the outlines of all the stuff, all the kind of gross stuff going on up there. The mother is then in the corner.
Oh, God.
Sawing her own head off.
Disgusting. So effective, but yeah, she's hanging in the air, just sawing her head off.
Hanging in her air like her brother, sawing off her own head.
Which leads to Peter.
Fully possessed.
The Peter character jumping out the window.
So at that point, he can't deal. He chooses to jump out the window. So then we see shadow of the mother's headless corpse, because we hear the corpse drop, and then two things, like ba-boom, ba-boom. And then the corpse flies overhead. We see a little claw.
Was that the mother's corpse that hit for the second thought, or was that the dog? Because we heard dog panting.
There's a head and there's a corpse. So I don't know if both hit. Okay. I don't know if there's two thuds. I don't even remember. Anyway.
Not the point of the scene, yeah.
It goes into the treehouse.
Yes.
The house of pain.
The headless corpse floats up.
House of pain. The headless corpse. The little shadow of light that's been showing you its demon possession whole movie goes onto the son's back, Alex Wolff's back.
Mm-hmm.
He wakes up in a trance, climbs up.
Happy music starts. He goes into the treehouse.
All hail Payman.
And Doubt is there to literally explain.
The whole cult's there.
Payman is one of the eight kings of hell. We had to reincarnate him. We got rid of your female form. We got you this new fresh vessel. Calls him Charlie. Right. Calls Peter by Charlie's name, and Charlie's head is there wearing a crown that Ann Dowd takes the crown off, puts it on Peter / Charlie's head, and all hail Payman as we go to credits.
The whole movie trying to get this demon into this male body.
It was one of the more convoluted plots and one of the more packed films. I don't think there's a wasted line of dialogue in this movie. And it's why we had to go kind of a little painstakingly through it, because there's so much to hit on.
Now everybody has the foundation. I think that a lot of the connections. We didn't connect everything,
right?
But it's there.
And the symbolism, too, is just everywhere.
So did you want to add any more best scenes, Michael? Because I think we have that on our schedule here. I do want to say that I think there's one good scene after another. I think this film is very much a genre film, but if you have good scenes stacked up on one another in any genre, it's very good.
You're gonna make a good movie.
I thought the sleepwalking dream sequence was horrifying.
That was awesome too. It was
very good.
We played so many head games watching this movie.
I purposely didn't talk about it before. For now, yeah,
you're so out of your element as to what the hell is going on your first time through. You have no idea, and you're playing catch up the whole time.
Yep.
And when a scene like that hits, where it's a back and forth dialogue scene where two actors are just playing off one another, and then you add that element of the paint thinner and the flames, I love that scene. I love the dinner scene. We both gushed about it in part one. Go back and listen to the full explanation for that. Everything Toni Collette does, I'm going to be angry if she doesn't get a nomination. She's awesome in this movie. Right down to her having that dead-eyed stare where she's sawing off her own head. My God, was it scary as shit, but she was awesome in it, and awesomely effective.
She plays a dream state. She plays a compromised state where she's compromised by the demon, and it's like she flashes her eyes to show that, oh, this is me being compromised by the demon.
Yeah.
My judgment being askew. And then here's me at the dinner table, like, just no filter.
Yeah, looking like the devil, by the way.
And here's me back to normal out in the world. Again, a little off, but she's... her performance is phenomenal. And then, of course, this is me possessed by a demon, Toni Collette. Oh, my God.
And the little things this film does, too, which I could chalk up for a best scene. Like, say what you want about how the grandmother's body got up in the attic in the first place. But they, you're asking the question, well, if you have a dead body around, wouldn't it start sticking up the joint? Well, they answer that before you can even ask it. The father comes home one day when Toni Collette has just destroyed a miniature. And he says, what's that smell? And you're fresh off the vision of the paint thinner thing. So you think she might have done something with flames or something. No, the smell ends up being the dead, rotting corpse that's in the attic that just got moved there.
Yes.
The little thing, the movie was really well done in that aspect as well, I thought.
any more best scenes there, Mike? Or that we get into the worst
covers
stuff?
Them mostly for me. I don't know if you have anything extra.
I talked about a few throughout, but dinner table and the dilemmas and the crisis climax there of the two main characters, the son and the mother. Now, I don't have many worse scenes. I have a worst moment. Obviously, when the girl is rebuked by her teacher in the early portion of the movie, she's making some knick-knack, probably in honor of payment there, her little imaginary friend Buddy in her mind.
As all kids do, yeah.
Before she gets, you know, the severed head of a bird mm-hmm. to put on that little knick-knack, because that's what you put on them.
Right.
Severed pigeon heads.
Kids being kids.
Silly kids. The teacher rebukes her, and then, of course, that bird, which she needs to complete mm-hmm. her little imaginary friend's guy there, action figure, flies into a window. The worst part of that scene is none of that. It's the reaction of the kid in the glasses. He is a terrible actor. He's delayed.
Did not think you were going here.
And he just straight goes, "Oh my God." I just hated that kid right then and there. He's a terrible actor. I didn't buy it for a second.
All right. I didn't even notice
he
it.
He was
yeah.
like kid number two in the movie.
Something I got to look out for now. We know my worst scene.
Played by Lucas Haas.
Oh God. Got to cancel him again. My worst scene, it's not even really a worst scene. It's the fault of this movie being so good for the buildup. And I just thought the payoff, I alluded to it in part one. I just thought the payoff for me was lacking some of the explanations as far as how the cult could have acted and been responsible for these things. But you said it. This is a script with armor. Everything that is a question could also be chalked up to, well, it was a demon did it. You know, a spirit did it.
Right.
They were possessed, so they didn't notice it. So there is that to fall back on, which is passable.
They were half-possessed.
Right.
I mean, there's literally degrees of demon possession and influence in this movie. So it's just like their compromised state. Oh, okay, what can the demon get away with during that state? And I'm right. You're right that I'm right. That it is plot armor.
Gee, thanks, man.
Good point there, buddy.
Nothing glaringly like, oh my God, it took me out of the movie. Really solid script, really solid movie.
All right, so we ready to get into themes?
Yeah, let's do it, man. I'm excited for you to unleash this.
This is a rare thing where we talk about the themes of a movie, but I think this is so unique, this story, that I did want to do a little bit of a deep dive. Take this for what it's worth with a grain of salt. I'm not a symbologist with hair like Tom Hanks in the Da Vinci Code movies, but I do think I have a read on this, if it's right or not.
He's short-selling himself. You're being modest. You did a hell of a job here, and I'm excited for you to do it out.
I didn't hear this being said in other places.
Let me set this up for you. This is, again, we said this isn't something that anyone has said thus far. Also, Mike came to me, and he kept this right on the head. He said, I see this as an allegory for this, and I'll let him explain the whole
story.
Well,
not an allegory.
Well, yes. Symbolic, yes, better word. It's not something that we've seen. It's kind of a very unique angle. It's not something you're going to find other places, at least not that we found. So here it is, the Also Mike explanation about the theme and overarching, I guess you would say, idea of this movie.
So the big thing is, I'm glad you mentioned that distinction, because an allegory is something like the Chronicles of Narnia. The Chronicles of Narnia basically takes animals and puts it on the story of Jesus, all right? Animals represent the story of Christ. That lion
it's just about
Jesus.
A lion.
It equals Jesus. No, that's an allegory. And C.S. Lewis made that very abundant throughout his post-writing life. J.R.R. Tolkien writes The Lord of the Rings. It is not an allegory, and he is very emphatic about the fact that it's not an allegory. The orcs don't represent the Nazis, and the hobbits don't represent the Irish, and this doesn't. No, this there's not equal signs between these things. It's a story, and I wanted to make a fantasy a quest story, and then I have all these influences going on in my head, so I have imagery to this, imagery
against
to that.
The backdrop of World War II, yeah.
But I'm not trying to retell the story of Jesus' passion with animals.
Right. So not going to crucify a tiger.
And I don't think Hereditary is retelling any kind of whatever other fable with Toni Collette's. So I think this movie has a lot of imagery. And I think, you know, you could definitely say that the text and one of the biggest and perhaps the biggest level of symbolism is all about mental illness. Because in the past, in many movies from Amityville Horror, let's take Amityville Horror, in the real life event, the husband was mentally ill and he killed his whole family.
Yes.
This is proven. This is in the crime books. He's mentally ill. He kills his whole family. He was not possessed by a demon. That is a metaphor that people have used to try to explain his mental illness, because we can't imagine a man who would do this, right? So he has to be possessed by a demon. And I think all throughout throughout time, from biblical times on up till now, we have explained mental illness in this way. In fact, in primitive times, they just said they had demons in them.
Yeah.
Literally.
Shock therapy, trying to get them out, sure.
So I think that the fact that this is a demon possession movie, the fact that mental illness is all over the text, like we said, there's also a lot of symbolism about mental illness working in now.
No question.
Psychology. In psychology, you have debates about what causes a certain brain activity. You have the chemistry debate, the psychiatry debate, you have the nature debate, right? What's the brain chemistry doing? What's inherited from mom and dad?
Yeah, nature versus nurture, that whole...
And then how you're raised, the nurture. So it's nature versus nurture. And I think that's how the two-hander of forces working on this family here, you have the nature of the demon that's inherited, that's passed on from
that's family hereditary member.
That's hereditary. Passed on literally from one male to another until they can't have a male, so they pass it on to the granddaughter. Literally passed on, that little buddy, imaginary friend, passed on from male to male. They're all killing themselves, and in many ways the mother is afraid of it, just like many people who live in families,
it's like
where there's mental illness, they're afraid of I've heard a lot of people say this.
It's like the royal family bloodline in England, except it's this demon.
Yes. But people with mental illness in the family, that runs in the family, are many ways terrified of it coming down to them
without
or their
question
kids.
Yep.
So that's very abundant in this movie, and the wife is kind of on edge from the beginning, as is the husband. Now, the main theme here, in my opinion, is this is about the destruction of a family and of the American dream of a family in many ways. This is a prosperous family. Both parents are working. This is a son and a daughter. This is the grandma living in the house. This is an artistic mother and a father who's a businessman. And you have
affluent. It's a very obviously affluent suburban.
I don't think it's an accident that they're super duper white.
I don't think there's a minority in this film.
Right. I don't think that's an accident.
Which is its own issue and whatever, but.
But textually speaking, like I said, I think demon possession is a metaphor, usually a metaphor for mental illness. But let's just bring it back to the fact that it's a metaphor for self-destruction. We don't blame self, the body chemistry going wrong, or the nurturing, or whatever, the combination thereof. We blame a demon. We just put a face on it. And
nice.
So families don't just self-destruct. You need that nature versus nurture happening on it. So a combination of forces, it works within the plot of the story, because you always need conflict in a story. And so you have that that triangle of forces. You got this family trying to survive,
mm-hmm.
and they're conflicted, they're compromised, like we said, different levels of possession before they actually fully possessed. You have the nature that is the demon, and you have the nurture that is the cult scurrying around in your attic.
I like it. All right. The groundwork has been laid.
I don't think mental illness is enough, because you have in mythology, early on in the movie, you have the teachers of the classes talking about Iphigenia and the sacrifice of the daughter by the
Heracles,
Greek.
Yep.
Yes, so you have that. You have that going on. You have one family member sacrificing another. Then later on in the movie, this is where we get into some financial crisis imagery. And I don't think it's by accident. I think there's a lot of stuff happening here, and I haven't heard many people talk about it this way.
I was just going to say, this is the kind of unique spin that you've put on it yourself. The mental illness, it's not hard to find, but it's also been discussed a lot in relation to this script.
Right.
And like you said earlier in this review, it's also blatant in the script. They discuss it, the characters discuss it. So
right.
Subtlety of it wouldn't be very, very established. But the financial imagery that you're going to get into, this is the unique spin.
So again, that main theme or that main operating thesis statement of the movie is destruction of a family, correct?
Yes.
That's where we got to work off of that principle. Now, financial crisis imagery, what put it in my mind? The sculpture of the houses stacked on one another reminded me of a AAA rated bond based on subprime mortgages. It just, when those bonds were put together, it was a bunch of different mortgages, some prime, some subprime down the line. It was mostly subprime, the ones that went toxic.
And why were you able to make that link? What
so
in your
like
life?
So it's like three houses. I worked on, I interned on Wall Street, or a Wall Street investment bank out of Greenwich, Connecticut. And they gave us a crash course in it. I studied it afterwards in college. I did not go into finance after I got out of school, but it was during college, I think my sophomore summer, where I actually saw it up close, well before it went wrong. It was like 2006. It went wrong in 2008.
Just before.
The excess was ridiculous. The parties were crazy. But I worked for an asset-backed securities department, and they were literally putting together those deals at the time, rating them AAA. Making sure that all the agencies had AAA on it. And all, of course, all these things would go toxic. So watch Too
Big to
Fail. I'd
like to remind
to
everyone, this is the man that said Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles 2, The Secret of the Ooze, was one of the best movies in 1991 last episode. Go ahead.
Was I wrong? No. Too Big to Fail, Michael Lewis book, obviously The Big Short, which is a Michael Lewis book made into a movie. Christian Bale.
Steve Carell, big movie. Should have won Best Picture that year, I think.
The Occupy Wall Street movement happened. Mr. Robot is kind of into this and indirectly.
Big time.
So there's a lot of, you know, art that's been working its way down after, as like the aftershock of the financial crisis.
Yeah, we're a good decade removed. Yeah.
When I saw that middle house being crushed from the top and bottom, not by other anything else's, but other houses,
mm-hmm.
it just reminded me of a subprime mortgage bond.
It's a fascinating take. It really is.
The bonds market is what fucked the economy and the trading and obviously the over leveraging of it all, basically gambling with your mortgages. And,
can you go into that at all?
Issuing, well, the whole problem with the subprime mortgage crisis was that they were issuing mortgages to people that couldn't handle them. They were putting in triggers, kind of like a, you know, the Jeremy Lin trade, where
yeah,
you
poison
have a
pill.
Poison pill at the end of the contract that just balloons up your refi. Plus, you have all the little things where you can, your percentages, the debit ratios don't work out. Anyway, it's a total mess. People that probably shouldn't have been given loans were given loans, but it's made worse by the fact that they're over-leveraging it on Wall Street, and that's with derivatives, and it's a huge mess to understand anyway.
So
corrupt,
it's your
fraudulent on many levels, and just irresponsible, levying people looking to get golden parachutes, get in, get out, make money, make interest, a lot of too many middlemen.
So just to summarize where you are at this point, you're saying literally the dollhouse aspect, that middle part of that house being overtaken by the top and bottom, which could kind of be symbols for the class system, as the housing on the class system, the middle class getting squeezed out.
And in the bottom, that's right there. So middle class, that's a great point. I didn't notice that. But middle class. The middle house being a middle class, if that's true, then that makes sense.
I mean, it goes right in line with the but you're saying literally it's about the housing market being
right,
basically destroyed.
Being destroyed, and obviously the house on the bottom gets the worst of it. Definitely the house in the middle has a problem too. So what drove this home for me is that teacher giving a lecture on the Great Depression. Like, I'm still like, all right, I don't necessarily think it's financial imagery. I saw one thing, right?
This is from the Gospel of Also Mike. Simple. When there is a scene about a classroom with a lesson being taught, there's more to the lesson.
Veronica is really every movie. Every movie, when a teacher is up there talking about anything, it's going to fit into the theme.
It's blatant subtext is what it is.
It's blatant subtext being literally just spat out of the mouth. So while the son's being possessed or about to be possessed, they're giving a lecture on the Great Depression. I think it was before he went to the bathroom, honestly. It wasn't that pivotal lecture. We're just kind of seeing him get contorted. So the Great Depression, the financial crisis was the biggest crash since then, biggest Wall Street crash, that is. There was a bubble going into it. It wasn't home mortgages that caused it necessarily, but of course you can draw a parallel. If they just talked about the financial crisis in that scene, that would have been even more on the nose. So they took the next best thing, the Great Depression. Now, Great Depression also works as a double entendre for the mental illness factor, which again, I think is probably more prevalent, but now you have King Payman, right?
Sure.
His name is literally Payman. That's one thing.
It is.
So that's my first connection. He is a Middle Eastern goddess turned into a male.
And this is legit. This is research that you've done on King Payman on your own.
Denofgeek.com, Thrillist.com talks about him quite a bit. He's destroying two parents, two towers of the family, literally. So this happens, you know, the trading, the willy-nilly trading after 9/11, you know, those
Look
years.
Look at you.
Yeah.
You're not wrong.
It makes sense.
It's great symbolism.
Like I said, during the plot breakdown, Ellen, the grandmother, showered with coins that are fake
Literal
wedding.
Coins, yeah.
Payment is all about wealth and the promises of wealth to his followers. The conjurers get pounds of money, mounds of money like Scrooge McDuck. So I'm not going out on a limb here. I think the symbolism is pretty straightforward when you take it from those four or five branches. They are conjuring a demon of mischief that promises extreme wealth. Mischievous trading on Wall Street, mischievous being a very understated word, just like the mischievous demons in this movie. So on the same level, they cause the financial crisis. So bam, I think we have lines drawn. I think these metaphoric... these metaphors and all this imagery expressed in the film is stacking up. So the cult symbolizes outside forces nurturing this family, infecting them like a virus, though, infecting them inside out is this demon, is this nature, the nature, the chemistry of it, and what's always been in the past a metaphor for mental illness. Bottom line is you have the destruction of a family, which is going to have major implications on the community, at least, but if not the world around them.
So in summation, you see a movie about the god of mischief that's taking over a young man's body, and I literally got a text that said, I see a lot of parallels to the financial crisis in this. I had no idea what you were talking about, but having you just walk us through it, I think you're absolutely right when you say this stuff stacks up, and it can't all be by coincidence or mistake or happenstance. There's plenty of evidence here that suggests that there's more to the story than just a demon. I think you finding that symbolism of the middle part of that house being crushed.
Well, you actually crystallized that for us.
The middle class.
Good. That would make a world of sense.
But it's nothing I would have caught, and it's not anything I've seen anyone catch, is my point.
Good teamwork. I didn't mention the dollhouse imagery or the motif, because we did have an argument about that. So my argument's probably a little shaky, as you tore it apart during pre-production.
I don't know about preparing it apart, but yeah, it's really, I want to stay on what you,
anyway, there's
what
houses
about
in the motifs of this movie too. There's houses, there's little houses, there's big houses. I thought just the houses meant, you know, housing market stuff. You know?
I think the idea that you can see this and walk away on your second viewing about that kind of comparison, I don't want to call it an allegory, like you said, but that comparison, that there was this message in the subtext, that this is basically not only a horror movie, a demon movie, a possession movie, but basically the dark version of The Big Short, is kind of a cool thing.
I mean, you make The Big Short, but then you go kind of another direction.
Right. It's The Big Short with the lights turned off, essentially.
You know, this is kind of The Big Short with animals, though. It might be an allegory.
The little girl was Jesus all along, yes.
Who is Ryan Gosling?
Mind-blowing when you first presented it to me. And I mean that. I'm not trying to blow smoke up your ass. It's not anything
I
would have caught.
Well, I noticed it because of personal experience.
Sure.
So it's not like I figured it out just by whatever, but...
No, you're the smartest man alive, is what we've discovered here today.
I feel better about myself than I did before. I was very anxiety about putting this out there. I don't know if it'll take. Again, take it with a grain of salt. I think it stacks up. That's my opinion.
I don't think there's any question that there's enough evidence here to point into the direction of this having a message having to do with the financial crisis.
Yeah, I wonder, and you brought if down it to the line, light. He'll talk about it.
So you want to get into grades? What we think about this overall?
I'm a little higher on it than you. I think it has some flaws. Like, I don't disagree with you that the end is a little clunky, and in many ways,
which is my biggest sin for the movie. Yeah, I can't bash it because it's too good to bash. And the fact that the ending to me is a victim of how good the setup is. Can you really take that many points off for it?
In a horror movie without a jump scare, have you been more freaked out?
No, this is just
history.
The creepiest movie I think I've ever seen. And like, especially for first time viewing, it's
so it works as a horror movie and still, it is not that conventional, just wait, boo kind of thing.
It's a horror movie in the way Silence of the Lambs has been classified as a horror movie. I mean, Get Out had more jump scares than this, and Get Out is not a jump scare movie.
It's almost like a thriller in the sense that it's a fate worse than death that they're stacked up against. Well, that's kind of involved in a horror movie, too. I guess I got to
My
screenwriting terminology in terms of genre.
You just gave us a class in economics, so I think you're good for the day there. You might want to...
I rambled a lot about... I said big words. I didn't really put together how the financial crisis happened. I know there's derivatives involved, and then I know there's the mask and Mr. Robot, and they burn a lot of money in terms of protests, and it's very cool.
I stopped listening.
Phil Collins music.
As soon as the X and Y axis had no words, I stopped listening in those classes. I'm personally a B+ 87 on it because of that sin. You are higher on it than
I'm a little higher. I have it as an A- 91, which is up there for me on the year. It's top three right now.
Wow.
And I'm pretty bullish on it, to use a Wall Street term. Yeah, that's what I see at the moment. I'll watch it again at some point, and we'll see if it holds up. I think we're going to touch on this movie again, as we said in our Oscar lens, because it's going to be involved, or at least it's going to be in the conversation for Best Actress for sure.
You should run for president with that business background you just pitched.
I have enough, you think?
You got to dye your hair first.
Derivatives and some of this and some of that.
Listen, it's not a conclusion that you're going to find anywhere else. Also, Mike was the first here to present it. What are your thoughts on it? Give us some feedback. Did we open some eyes to you? Did he make you see something like he did for me that you wouldn't have seen in first or second viewing? We want to hear feedback from you about this movie. This is the hot movie of the moment. And like Mike just said, we're going to hear more and more about it, we think, for a couple Oscar categories as the year goes on. And we will. This is not going to be the last time that we probably address this movie. We'll probably have at least one more.
How stupid will I look in 2 months? We'll see.
It was about the Ebola virus. How did you not get that?
Guys, this is Happy Days. If it was a horror movie, Ari Aster.
He saw an episode of Care Bears once, and he just got really inspired. Let us know. Did you see any other symbolism leading to any other areas that were addressed by Ari Aster in this film or this screenplay? What do you think of Toni Collette's performance overall? And what about that ending of Act One? My God, that scene where the Charlie character loses her head. Did you see that coming? Comment on all this and more. We want to hear from you. Our social media is Mike, Mike, and Oscar on Facebook, Mike, and Oscar on Instagram, MM and Oscar on the Twitter machine, Mike, and Oscar at Reddit.com, Mike, and Oscar.com, Mike, and Oscar at gmail.com. Reach out to us if you see us on iTunes, Stitcher, SoundCloud. Be sure to leave us a review and a rating. We really
would
appreciate that.
Those reviews really help. Yes, thank you.
Otherwise, guys, we will see you next time. Thanks for listening. Reality does suck. Keep watching movies with us. You want to take us out with a clucking sound?